Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, and why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in this series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com. Get your autograph copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Solar wind tonight is a medium 439.6 kilometers per second at the moment. Sunspot 898 no longer poses any kind of threat to Earth. There was a coronal ejection, but it is likely that it missed Earth. And we're happy about that. Doubtful there will be any aurora for the next few days anyway. STS-121, which is the Discovery launch recently, is performing flawlessly in space right now. We want to encourage you to write us with the call letters of your local AM radio station. We will write them and try to get them to carry X Squared Radio on their program schedule for the live broadcast. We want you to know that we are coming to you live through BBS Radio Network and through the satellite feed via Global Star Radio Network. Next week on X Squared Radio, we will have Brent Miller. I know we've tried to have him on here a couple of times before. We have had the strangest technical difficulties resulting in the complete loss of audio from those two shows. But we promise that we will solve these problems, even if we have to make a backup to a backup, and we'll try to have all those problems solved for us. Honestly, if you've heard him before, you need to catch this program. We have done it twice in the recent past. Trust me, there is information you need to have, so make sure that you tune in on July 16th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. If you want to stay current on our programs, guests, books, CDs, DVDs, and other outstanding stuff for your space, you can make X Squared Radio your favorite place on the web. We want to welcome our AM affiliates and your many requests that this program be placed onto XM and Sirius. I believe that everything we do will eventually affect the universe, and your efforts are having their effect, and I appreciate it. We are so pleased that we could have our guest here tonight that we have. Lloyd Pye is an author, researcher, and lecturer in the field of alternative knowledge. He calls on over 30 years of experience to write and speak about the origins of life, human origins, hominoids, Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Yeti, and others, and the work of Zachariah Sitchin. This broad base of knowledge makes him one of the world's leading proponents of the intervention theory of origins, which stands in sharp contrast to Darwinism, creationism, and intelligent design. He is also the caretaker of the Star Child skull, and for the last few years has been seeking genetic proof that the skeletal remains are indeed not from this world. I met him while he was speaking at a MUFON gathering in Charlotte, North Carolina. He is dedicated to spreading the truth that we have never been alone on this world, and has developed that case to one of the highest degrees on earth, in my opinion. Mostly by word of mouth, his book, Everything You Know Is Wrong, Book 1, Human Origins, has sold over 30,000 copies on TV. Lloyd has been featured on The Learning Channel, Mystery of the Skulls, Animal Planet, that's Animal X, Extra, Best UFO Segment of the 1990s, London's Richard and Judy Show, England's equivalent to Oprah Winfrey, four times on Channel 13 Fox TV in Tampa, Florida, naturally Nolans with Frank Davis on WWL-TV, CBS in New Orleans, and WJTV in Jackson, Mississippi, also CBS, and he has given over 200 lectures in the U.S. and around the world, Egypt, Netherlands, England, Australia. We are very honored to have you. Please welcome with me Lloyd Pye. How are you tonight?
Very good, Brooks. Thank you for that comprehensive introduction.
Well, I try to do my best. I try to do my research, and I was really a privilege to meet you in person at the lectures, because that's just a rare opportunity for many of us. You know, we get to hear people on the radio, we get to read about them in magazines or read their books, but to meet them in person, shake their hand, hear their story, feel their passion, that makes it all worthwhile. And I can tell you that I'm impressed with your dedication to the project. It's so easy these days to just give up when the money runs out, and I don't think you've done that at all.
No, it I went well past when the money ran out, and have had to unfortunately pay for it for doing that. But on the other hand, I really, as you say, believe in it and very passionate about it. I think that it's a project worthy of any kind of sacrifice, really, if we can bring it to a satisfactory conclusion, which, you know, we're doing our best to do. So we're just going to have to keep our heads in the game as best we can, and keep our noses pointed upfield, and hope that we finally get into the end zone.
Well, I'm with you on that. I I've been trying to keep up with the developments on the Star Child Project. I go to your website on a regular basis, and there have been many developments. In fact, there's been a recent news release, which is what prompted me to call you again. I recently heard that you have been sought out by none other than National Geographic for some information. Can you bring us up to date on that?
Right. Just out of the blue, National Geographic is, you know, they're very much mainstream people and pretty much icons of the mainstream, but they have the National Geographic cable TV show, and that's a little different. They're allowing some things in, apparently, there that they wouldn't allow into the magazine. So they have a segment, I guess you'd call it, called Is It True? You know, a program segment type called Is It True? Or Is It Real? Or is, I forget exactly what it is. I had not heard of it before they contacted me. Anyway, they said they were going to do a documentary special, a new one-hour documentary special on the ancient astronaut theory. And as you know, that was initiated by basically Eric von Daniken in the late 1960s, and ancient astronaut theory stayed for a very long time as the terminology. And then later, when the work of Zechariah Sitchin came to be better known, it sort of has evolved into what's now called intervention theory. But they want to call theirs the ancient astronaut theory, so that's what you would look for in late October when it's supposed to be coming out. But anyway, they have talked to von Daniken himself, to Sitchin, and to me, and the main reason they wanted to talk to me, I think, notwithstanding my knowledge about ancient astronauts, but they wanted to talk about the Starchild skull, which seems to be, right now, probably in the world, the object with the best chance of proving scientifically to a degree that never before has occurred that possibly alien life existed or at least visited or was on the Earth at some point 900 years ago. And that's what the whole Starchild Project has been about, to try to determine what the Starchild skull really truly is from a scientific standpoint. And they had heard about it, and so they said, we would like to film it and put you, you know, put it and you in the show. So they did. We met in El Paso, where the real skulls are kept with their owners. And even though they've been cut into considerably now for the testing that we've had done, they wanted to film the real thing, and I can certainly understand that. So we met, and we filmed for about 3 hours, talking about half the time was spent talking about ancient astronauts, and the other half was spent bringing everybody up to speed visually as much as possible on the Starchild skull. It's been filmed for other programs, the ones that you mentioned in the introduction, but I don't know that it's ever been done quite as thoroughly as they did, because their National Geographic was very sophisticated equipment. One of those new $100,000 high-definition cameras was used. I mean, it looked like a very quality production. So I'm looking for a good show now. How they will treat us, how they will treat the Starchild, I'm sure they will have some people there come on who will say, you know, negative things about it and assure the audience that they don't necessarily need to believe whatever, you know, the things that I say or what anybody says on those kinds of shows. They always have somebody from the mainstream on there saying, well, no, it's not really true what they're saying. We see it completely different, and you can believe us because we're the experts. So that will no doubt be a part of it. But on the other hand, it will be very good exposure in a mainstream venue, and those are always precious because they bring awareness of the Starchild to many more people each time, and this one hopefully will bring more awareness at a mainstream level than probably we've ever had before.
Well, you know, what I find a little frustrating but refreshing at the same time, for, I don't know, 15 or 20 years, we've been called paranormal, we've been called out of the mainstream, we've been called fringe, but it is clear that not only is world interest building, but the credibility of some of this evidence, some of it's ancient, some of it's modern, But the advent of the internet and being able to proliferate this information around the planet, because obviously you have to go around the mainstream to get this stuff out. What has happened is, I think it's all about market share. I think National Geographic is seeing the pinch, and they're seeing, you know, networks like BBS Radio and Global Star and a lot of programs like this one with millions of listeners, and those listeners are writing National Geographic and saying, boys, don't you think it's about time to get that $150,000 camera out and go down and see Lloyd Pye?
Well, that's possible. It's possible that they got some kind of pressure from somebody, but I have to tell you this. The producers who were given the assignment of doing it really didn't know much about the subject going in. They just
really?
Drew it as an assignment. It was something that was how it was decided, I don't know. But I didn't get any sense at all that it had come from any kind of pressure or awareness, fundamental awareness that they had that this is, you know, this is kind of a groundswell desire on the part of people. Now, I agree with you 100% in that there is a huge market in the world, around the world, because I deal with it on a regular basis, getting emails from around the world relative to the Star Child. So I know that information moves globally on the internet to people who are interested in this stuff. That's the thing. What I think the mainstream doesn't understand is that there is an awful lot in the many, many millions of people around the world who are very interested in, quote, unofficial, unsanctioned information that the mainstream either doesn't want you to have or doesn't want you to believe or doesn't want you to consider, or for whatever reason they denigrate, they ignore, they ridicule, you know, they do everything they can to make it not seem worthwhile, but there's still a huge number of people out there who want that information precisely because the mainstream doesn't seem to want it to be out there. And certainly the Star Child would fall into that category. And just as the Da Vinci Code has shown that there is a massive audience out there that when it can be motivated, when it can be mobilized, will respond. And that's because that was information the mainstream didn't, you know, the religious mainstream didn't want out and didn't want considered seriously. But the genius of the work itself, the pace of it, you know, the fact that it was an extremely compelling read and then a good movie if you've seen the movie. So the market's there, and people are just, you know, simmering under the surface of awareness of the mainstream. But the internet, I agree 100%, is fueling it, and the internet gives people like us, the fringe, the paranormal, the outsiders, what they give us a platform that we never had before for reaching our audience around the world. And that's a trend. That is a change. That is something that's coming on. And I'm experiencing, in fact, that right now with the book that I've written about the Star Child, about my 7 years with the Star Child Project. And I've written that book. Now, this is a book that as much as 2 or 3 years ago wouldn't have had a chance, not a chance really, at a top level mainstream publishing house. But now, given the success of the Da Vinci Code, it does. And so it's going probably to be evaluated and picked up and published by a mainstream house because there is a change going on, that exact change that you're talking about. Radio shows like yours, particularly the internet, and cable channels like the Sci-Fi Channel, Discovery Channel, Learning Channel, that allow things like this in. There is just, it's, you know, it's just a groundswell, and it is there, but I don't know, as I said earlier when I started talking in this segment, I don't know that it's necessarily excuse me, penetrated to the highest levels like at National Geographic, but it certainly is upwelling, and over the next year or two or three, it's going to become even more comprehensively popular, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's talk about the Star Child a little bit. I know in Charlotte, when you gave us your lecture, it was very comprehensive. We had slides which so far is difficult to do on radio, but maybe you could recount for us, for our listeners, how the Star Child was discovered in the first place. First of all, when was it discovered?
Well, it was discovered around 1930 by a woman who at the time was about a 15-year-old girl. And she was of Mexican heritage, and it was found in Mexico. Her parents had come to the States when they were young, and by the time she was 15, they had become legal immigrants, so they were able to come and go as they wanted. So they went back to visit the old home village and take their kids to see and all that, their cousins and such. And so when they got there, she and her siblings were told that in this area, which was about 100 miles southwest of Chihuahua, which is sort of near the Copper Canyon, very rugged, high desert area, and they were told not to go in the caves or the mine tunnels in the area because that's dangerous, just dangerous, period, and forbidden, and don't do it. So, you know, teenager, tell them what not to do, tell them, you know, spice it up with a little potential danger, and she was off, you know, to do some exploring. And she found in a mine tunnel, she went into a mine tunnel, exactly what she wasn't supposed to do, and found a human skeleton lying on the dirt on its back, just a skeleton. She got closer and she saw that one of its arms, in the upper part of the arm, had a hand, what she called a misshapen hand, wrapped around the bone, and it was, you know, the bone of another skeleton coming up out of the dirt beside it. And because it was a grave that had been dug, she didn't know, of course, 900 years ago, but it doesn't matter. If you're in a mine tunnel, you're not going to have any rain to compact the dirt. So the dirt was as loose, more or less, as the day the grave was dug. So she was able, with her own hands, to dig it loose and find the other skeleton, which she called misshapen too, misshapen body, smaller than that one. And so she was able, by hook and by crook, to recover and sneak back into the States both of the skulls, somewhat damaged, but still she got the two skulls back and kept them her whole life. And then when she was on near death in the early part of the 90s, she willed them to some friends to keep after her death. And then after about 5 years, they didn't want to keep the two skulls anymore, so they gave them to another couple, and that couple, the woman of that, this was a younger couple, she had been a neonatal nurse, and she knew a lot about deformity, human deformity. And furthermore, it just so happened, they both belonged to MUFON. And so, you know, the combination of things, she took one look at that skull and she said, you know, I don't think this is deformity. I think this could be the skull of a gray. We'd like to get this thing checked out and tested. And so the person who gave it to them said, well, as long as you leave our names out of it and the names of the people that found it, you can do whatever you want. It's yours to run with, do what you want. So they took that and contacted me. And I thought it would be fairly easy once we brought the weirdnesses of it to the attention of the scientific community that they would jump all over it like they did Otzi. You remember the Neolithic man who was found under the glacier in the Alps. Science jumped all over him, and they've pumped about $20 million into testing everything about him that you can think of. So I thought it would be, you know, not nearly as expensive, but I thought it would be the same kind of comprehensive testing to see what this incredibly weird thing is. Not so. Didn't happen. It's been extremely hard to force science, really, to do its job on this. Because this is not an answer. With OTSI, you know, it's going to tell us about our fairly near ancestors of about 5,000 years ago to 10,000 years ago. So that's good information to have. Well, nobody really wants to hear that this skull might be of an alien or of an alien-human hybrid. So
exactly. That
science tends to look the other way as much as it can.
It doesn't fit the grade school anthropological charts.
I'm sorry, say again?
It doesn't fit the grade school anthropological chart.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It just doesn't fit what everyone who's in positions of authority now in science, and for that matter in religion and government either, want to believe, which is that we are supreme, alone in the universe and supreme within our realm and all of that. And I think, you know, I know they all know better, that certainly government does with the UFOs and things that they have on hand. And I think we all suspect, really, that we're not all there is, you know, that there's just more out there. But as long as it's not official, we don't have to really confront that issue. We don't have to deal with it. And that's the kind of thing that the Star Child could do, is make it official and make a lot of people very unhappy in having to confront a reality that, while they may even know 100% that it's real, they don't want to have to deal with it at a public level. And so there's been a lot of very diligent ignoring of my pleas to get this thing, you know, tested for real. However, that said, we have managed over the 7 years to get a lot of testing done and to certainly reveal enough information to give us good cause to believe that if we can ever get it to the point, maybe the book will accomplish that, maybe the National Geographic show will, I mean, who knows, but something someday is going to be a triggering event that's going to force the hand of science, going to push them to the point where they can no longer ignore it for the most part, and will have to deal with it and confront it and bring out results that we can all believe in. And you know, when that day comes, we'll know for sure. But it's still a process of getting, you know, of getting science pushed to the edge of the cliff where they pretty much just have to jump. And yeah, that's, you know, that's going to take public, you know, public acclaim and public, the public pushing them.
Well, I can't tell you how many times I've spoken to people who either have made startling discoveries or read about startling discoveries relative to the presence of or activities of off-worlders, only to know or to have evidence disappear or be corrupted to the point that the case was successfully refuted. But, you know, the Star Child skull or the remains of the Star Child are unique in the world in the sense that that they have been preserved and they have a diligent caretaker, you, that's more or less, you know, babysat the bringing forth of the examination of these remains. Now, if my memory serves me correct, the first time that they did a DNA test on this, checked it against the human genome, you know, the human genome took 25 years to come up with the set of markers that sort of map the human genome. Now, we've got some that can, you know, do criminal evaluations. We know what certain genes control, but we're still babies at the human genome. But what happened when they put the first sample of Star Child DNA in the system and compared it to human DNA?
The first time that a DNA analysis was attempted was in Vancouver in Canada, and it was at a forensic lab, which is not a lab that was really equipped to do ancient DNA. The purpose of the test was to tell us, because it's very expensive to do the kind of analytical DNA discovery that we needed on ancient bone. So we were offered the opportunity to get a sort of a midway test, a forensic test, which would just tell us if it looked like it would be worth it to go to that extra effort to find out if the Star Child's DNA was or was not degraded to such a point that there was just no hope ever of recovering any of it. Now, that is a very common result, understand. It is common to have degradation to the point of no recovery of nuclear DNA.
Sure.
Not necessarily mitochondrial DNA, but that isn't what we needed. We needed nuclear DNA. So the Kennewick Man, for example, is a classic example of a well-known skull skeleton that had been degraded to the point where no DNA recovery, nuclear DNA, was possible. So, in fact, I don't think its mitochondrial DNA was even recoverable. Mitochondrial DNA is much more durable and easier to recover, but I think for the Kennewick man, neither one was. Mm. Someone can check me on that. I could be wrong. But I know the nuclear wasn't. So the Star Child, we just needed to know, is it indeed recoverable? Is it going to be worth the money, the time, the effort, and everything to find out? We suspected that it would be. Because if it was buried indeed in a mine tunnel for 900 years, that's the equivalent of a climate-controlled storage locker, really. Anybody's been in a cave knows you have these constant temperatures. There's no sun bleaching it. There's no water bleaching, leaching into it. It should be pretty much the same as it was when it went down 900 years ago. So we assumed it was going to be a good result. But this lab, in four attempts, got, you're supposed to get a level of recovery called 1,000 picograms of material. This was 200, maybe about 200 picograms, so like one-fifth of what they should have gotten. And yet they went ahead and they made a proclamation on it that it was a human and it was a male. Its nuclear DNA indicated that. So that would mean that there was no way that it was alien-human hybrid or an alien. It was simply a malformed human. Well, when that result came in, I just felt very confident it was wrong because the first two of those four had been contaminations. And the last two were those very, very slight 200 picogram recoveries using basically the same sample. In other words, you get a successful one on the third one, and they don't take a new sample. They just redo that sample to make sure that they got everything the way it was supposed to be. Anyway, long and short was the initial report looked like the Star Child was just simply a deformity. So a lot of people gave up on it at that point. I thought the lab was wrong. And I just wouldn't give up because everything else about that skull doesn't look normal. So when this one thing comes in saying that it is, I just couldn't accept it and wouldn't accept it. But I had to wait almost 4 years, 3 years and something again to get help from someone in England to get the money to pay for a DNA test at the higher level, at the diagnostic level of ancient DNA at a lab dedicated to that, which would have much less of a chance of contamination. And when that lab finally got it in 2003, it was able to determine that the results of the first lab were just wrong, period, just wrong.
Were
there was
a
mistake, in fact.
A larger sample size? The first sample is about a billion times smaller than an aspirin.
Yeah, it's not quite that. They cut off what they use to start with is a piece about the size of your little fingernail. That's
okay.
What they start with. Yeah. And they have to, they crush it up and they dissolve it. They rub off the outsides of it to get any human contamination. I mean, These labs that do this ancient DNA make the clean rooms of computer chip manufacturers look like dumps, those workers can't let a flake of their skin, a droplet of their breath, get on the sample or it's contaminated. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's so expensive. It's an extremely hard thing to do correctly, but it can be done, and it was done with the Star Child finally. So what they found was that its mitochondrial DNA was very easy to recover, in fact, and its nuclear DNA should have been. Everything about it, all the indications were that its nuclear DNA was going to be very easy to recover. But in seven attempts, it was not. They couldn't recover anything. They couldn't make a single primer look like it had seen anything in the mix. Now, the primers are all designed to recover human DNA.
Right.
So, what does that tell you? It's not seeing what it should see if, indeed, the Star Child is a normal human being, just deformed, but normal in every other way, having a normal father, normal mother kind of thing. So that was a problem that we couldn't overcome, because what can you do? The primers are just not functioning. So at that point in 203, I said, well, what do we do now? And they said, you're going to have to wait about 3 to 5 years until the technology in our field gets sophisticated enough that we can do this at another level in another way, and just approach it differently, because the primer system is just not going to work. And ironically enough, just a few weeks ago, like 3 weeks ago, maybe 4 weeks ago, somewhere in that range, those geneticists, and it's been 3 years now since 203, 206, so kind of right on schedule, I was notified that indeed a new prototype model is out there being tested, looking good, and probably by about 2 years from now, which is 208, there is going to be a new way to test the nuclear DNA of the star child without using the primers, a completely different way, completely different technique. Now, this is also big news because it's going to allow the testing of nuclear DNA for fossils, for Neanderthal man, for maybe even dinosaurs. So it's a big deal in the world of genetics. And so it's just, things are looking good and looking up, and we're going to get our answer. Still could be wrong. Now, Brooks, understand, still could be that it is indeed, you know, human. But everything up to this point indicates it's more than human. It's not entirely human.
Well, I was privileged enough to hold a replica of the skull in my hands. And it did, it felt small, but there were some things that I noticed about it. What I want to cover right now is how old do they think the living being was when it passed away?
Boy, Brooks, that's one of the most contentious issues that we deal with in this, because the skull itself looks old, looks like it's an adult. It's well sutured. It has a lot of very strong Wormian bones along the suture lines of the lambdoidal suture in the back of the head. It doesn't look like a kid's skull.
Right.
And yet, the little piece of maxilla, which is your upper right jaw, if you put your finger in the little dip of your lip right in the middle and wrap it around the right side of your upper jaw, that part of the jaw we had. And of this, with the star child, it had two teeth sticking down, and it had up in the bone, unerupted, several teeth. And you could see that this being, whatever it was, had teeth down that were well-worn, were crazed, and I mean, you could see these teeth had been in that head for quite a while and had done a lot of hard work chewing, doing whatever, and yet it had teeth up top ready to come down. So you think, initially we thought that's a child, which is why we called it the star child. Teeth down, teeth up. You have to assume it's a child.
Right.
But later, experts, when in looking at the teeth, would say, these teeth look like they've been in this head for quite some time doing heavy duty. Well, the argument that came back on that was that, well, if it was eating stone ground flour and stone ground corn and all that, it's going to be getting a lot of little stone chips. And that, and the human that was found with it, who was a female, her teeth were indeed ground pretty flat. Now, the star child's cusps were not flat, but the enamel had indeed been chipped away in several places. So the argument still goes on. There are those experts who say that if you've got those unerupted teeth, it has to be a child if it's human-like. But if it's more alien-like, it could have an extremely long lifespan. And so like a shark, it would need, when old teeth wore out, it would need new teeth to come in if indeed its life was going to expand into the hundreds of years, like, for example, the lifespans of some of the beings and people in the Bible, for those who are inclined to look at that. So we don't know. We really don't know. I just pretty much go with the child thing just because we started with that and we've kind of stuck with it on through. But this could have been a being that was very much older than a child at death. We just don't know, and there is no way to prove that genetically.
Yeah. Well, with normal dental analysis, you could say the presence of teeth still up in the gums is a definite sign that you've got something pre-adolescent there. But we pretty much know from other evidence, other beings, other skeletons that have been found around the planet, that multiple rows of teeth are quite common because of the extreme lifespan. This is the interface between eating and not eating, and it wears out. Our teeth maybe last about 100 years. That's about it. If we expected a permanent set of teeth to last much longer than that, they'd have to be made out of something harder than enamel, which I can hardly fathom in a biological being. So it would make
well,
sense.
We don't know about the durability of the teeth. The lab that took one of the two teeth was taken by a lab and ground up, the lab in Vancouver, and they didn't really say that it was harder than normal or not, and they were a dental lab, so they really should have known. Mm-hmm. However, they didn't. They made a passing comment that the bone itself was pretty hard to cut, and at the other lab, we found out that the bone was indeed extremely hard to cut, not just a little harder to cut, very hard to cut relative to what it should have been. So the bone itself, we know now, is certainly much harder than normal human bone. We also know that bone, the star child bone, is jam-packed with collagen, much more so than normal. So it really has a different consistency about itself relative to normal human bone. And these are, those are just one of the many, many things that make us feel very strongly that the star child is probably something other than entirely human, because all the things you look at to compare to a human don't match up. And the bone consistency and perhaps the tooth consistency, we do have one of the teeth left, so we may yet be able to test that out.
One piece of logic that I'd like to apply, I've been thinking about it since your lecture. If it is, in fact, a child, if they want to make that case, let's just assume that premise for the moment, then, and we assume that it is not from around here, that it either wasn't born here or it was born here. Let's consider both cases. If it wasn't born here, then that means that the child's parents would have had to have traveled across space with it or given birth to that child once they got to this planet. If the latter is true, then that means that aliens came to this planet and somehow had a hybrid, which this child could be, and then they left the planet or died, and we didn't find their remains or their aircraft. But
right.
So that those are the two possibilities.
Well, the one about the hybrid is almost certain to be the case. Well, it is. I mean, there's no doubt about it, because with the mitochondrial DNA, you might recall from the lecture, that tells us very clearly that the star child comes from one of the major, the star child's mother came from one of the major haplogroup types for Amerindian peoples of 900 years ago, meaning Indians. So it's unquestionable at this point in my mind anyway that its mother was a human being. Now, that's not really a problem in terms of the alien human hypothesis, simply because if you are an alien, let's say a gray because it looks so much like a gray.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you're a gray and grays, and you want to create a hybrid being with a human and yourself. Whatever the differences are in your chromosome count or whatever else, there are going to be things you're going to have to overcome genetically in the lab in order to make this work. You can't just have sex and make it happen, because that would be like having maybe a cat and a dog. It isn't going to work. you're going to need some genetic manipulation to make this occur. Now, to do that, you have, if these beings are close enough to where you think, maybe a dog and a cat is an extreme example, but, you know, they're mammals and they're kind of in the ballpark, kind of, you know. And I use that because the cheetah looks to be, in fact, a blend between dogs and cats. That,
sure.
That's what a cheetah is. In fact, it is a genetic blend between dogs and cats. So it can be done. It has been done. So if you're going to do that with a human being and anything else, you have to start in a genetics lab. And what you want to use there is the human's egg, because a sperm is just going to be too small. You can't really tell, you can't manipulate the sperm very well.
Right.
Whereas you can go in, we do it ourselves all the time. You can go in and do an egg is like a basketball compared to what they deal with if they try to genetically alter a sperm. So if you're going to make that happen, the thing you want to work on is the human egg. So the mother has to be the mother end of the equation. So we expected from the beginning, I did anyway, that if indeed it wasn't a pure alien, which I never really thought it was, I always had a feeling it was going to be a hybrid, then if its mother would be human, and that's what its mitochondrial DNA shows, because the mitochondrial DNA comes from mothers,
right.
Comes down from mothers. That's why we needed nuclear DNA from the beginning, because that shows the genetic heritage of both the mother and the father. Now, the nuclear DNA comes from inside the cell nucleus, that hence it's called the nuclear DNA, and mitochondrial DNA floats outside the nucleus in little small chips of DNA that are, again, more durable and easier to recover. So we know for sure its mother was human, and what we need is to see to analyze its nuclear DNA to see something more comprehensive about her DNA as well as the father's DNA. And it's really dad's DNA is what we have to have, because without that, we can't really be sure what it is.
Has there been any attempt to go back to the original village in Mexico and maybe discover if there was a relationship between this being and the village where it was found? If there was any?
No, there really hasn't, because when it was first taken on by the couple who got it, the stipulation from the people who gave it to them was that we do not want to be involved with this. And the couple that gave it to us, the woman who died, they didn't want to either, because both of those gentlemen work for the government, had jobs with the federal government, and therefore had pensions. And so, you know, if you're involved with the government and you start talking about, if you do anything to facilitate research into UFO reality or alien reality, you're really asking for trouble, and they know that. So they just, they don't want to be involved or have anything to do with it. Now, I could really press that issue. I'm sure I could. And I'm hoping, Brooks, is that when the book comes out, that it will be enough of a prod to those people to contact me or to contact the owners and say, okay, look, here's where you need to look. We have, you know, a general area. It's all we have, about 100 miles southeast of Chihuahua. But to find a specific village within that area is just impossible to know which would be the right one. But if there's enough notoriety, if there's enough publicity about it, then there are people out there. There absolutely are people out there. The woman who found it had family. They will probably come forward, and we will be able to pinpoint the village exactly, and maybe be able to go at that point and talk to people there and see what they know.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe go back to the cave and see if there are some kind of artifacts down in there.
Possibly.
Well, at first glance, I don't have one I can hold up here on the radio, but at first glance, what is the difference about this skull from a human skull? You were talking about the suture points, which...
Well, if people would like to see it for themselves, it's very easy to find on the Internet. You just go to www.starchildproject.com.
Mm-hmm.
That's www.starchildproject, all one word, .com. And on there, you'll find a couple of slideshows, early findings and recent findings. And that will, that's just pictures, you know, and with text underneath explaining them. And that will give you a tremendous background on what the differences are, why we think they're special, the star child is special and different. And you'll come away from that. It'll take probably, I would imagine, between 30 minutes and an hour for the average person to read through both of them. But if you do, then you're going to be up to speed. So if this is something you've not heard anything about up to now and you'd like to know more about, accessing the information both visually and textually is not hard. You just go to the Star Child Project website and there it is. But just to describe it in words, the Star Child skull, everything, there are eight main categories of measurement on a skull that you say have parameters that are within normal. All eight of those on the Star Child are not within normal. The eye sockets aren't normal. The neck isn't normal. The size isn't normal. The brain volume isn't normal. It doesn't have frontal sinuses. It doesn't have an inion at the back of the head. You know, that knot that we all have at the back of middle of our lower heads where our necks connect to our skulls, doesn't have one of those. It's so different in so many ways. There are sometimes some measurements on the Star Child relative to a normal human skull where it's 10 deviations away from the standard. Is 10 standard deviations away from a norm of a normal bell curve. So it's staggeringly different, Brooks.
Now,
I mean,
what would the eyes of this being, what would they have looked like?
This is one of the great, great arguments and debates that everybody has. They're so shallow. The sockets are so shallow. Their normal depth of a human eyeball is about 2 inches. The
really?
Depth of the Star Child is about a half inch, so it's about a quarter of normal depth. Then you, in a normal human eye socket, at the rear of that cone-like depth into 2 inches, it's kind of like a cone going in, at the rear of that is the optic fissure and the opening for the optic nerve.
Mm-hmm.
With the Star Child, all of that has been pushed down to the very bottom of the eye socket, such as it is, meaning that the eyeballs, if they're there, are sitting about in the middle of the nose rather than up at the top of the bridge of the nose as they are in a normal human being. So these eyes are going to be sitting at a different place in the face, number one. If they are normal eyeballs like we have, they're going to be bulging off the face like frog eyes. So that's going to be a weird look, too. Now, if they're smaller than ours, which is possible, they will still bulge off the face somewhat, but not to the extent of, like, literal frog eyes, which would be very, very dangerous for a being to have eyes like that.
Yeah, that doesn't seem to me to be a very robust design. I mean, you could walk into pine needles and be blinded. Unless they had really heavy.
Well, you could very easily just thump it, and you could thump it with your finger probably and knock it out. So yeah, it's not a good design if it's indeed an eyeball like ours sitting in the head. Doesn't mean that it is. It could be something else. We don't. Again, this is one of the great debates about what it would look like. I suspect it's going to have a smaller eyeball than we have because the socket itself is relatively smaller, and it's going to bulge out somewhat, but not to such a point that it's extremely dangerous. Like, again, frog eyes would be. It's the only example I can think of.
So you don't think the eyes?
But they're going to be strange. Whatever they are, they would have been strange eyes relative to ours, I think.
Well, that would make a lot of sense if the being or the father of the being came from another planet, they would have.
Right. Well, and the other option, of course, is that it just could have been blind, had no eyes at all. And if the deformity thing should hold up, that probably is what the answer would be. However, in deformity, I think everybody knows, you don't get symmetry. One of the hallmarks of natural deformity, when you have a being that's born that's not like it should have been. There was some kind of a mistake in the egg-sperm connection that created something radically different from normal. When you have that, it's always unusual looking. It's asymmetrical. It certainly doesn't look right. It doesn't look well put together. The star child is extremely symmetrical, maybe more symmetrical than normal human beings. I mean, normal human beings are not really A-plus symmetrical all the way around. We're all a little bit asymmetrical. If you want to see that, just, you know, the old deal about taking a picture of yourself, put a mirror, take a normal picture of yourself, put a mirror on one side and take the left half of your face mirrored and then do it to the right half of your face and you look like two different people. And that's everybody. But the star child, I suspect that if you did that to it, it would have looked an awful lot more symmetrical. The most beautiful people among human beings are the ones whose faces are the most symmetrical. And the star child would have had one of those kinds of faces because it is really well put together. So that being the case, it's hard to imagine that its eyes would have been dysfunctional if they were put together with the degree of symmetry that they were. And they really are amazingly symmetrical. For as weird as they look, they are absolutely symmetrical. And so I have to think that the whole head grew the way it grew because its genes were telling it to do that. And if that's the case, if its genes were telling it to grow that way, those are not human genes telling it what to do, because that's not a human head. So that's pretty much, you know, pretty much my feeling about the eyes. They are radically different, but they are so well put together. I suspect that there were eyes in there, but not like ours.
Excellent. Fascinating. Well, in the next hour, we've got about a minute and a half left in this one, but in the next hour, I'd like to talk a little bit about maybe the nature of the bone itself. Now, this wasn't petrified, was it? This is a preserved skull.
Yeah, this is no calcification at all. This is no fossilization, I mean. Yeah, this is absolutely well-preserved, well-preserved bone. No question about that.
I think that was, I have a degree in biology, and that was, to me, was the most fascinating part. I mean, surely the morphology of the being is fascinating, but when you're talking about human bone, you're talking about human bone. It's pretty much the same.
Yeah, it is, everywhere. And this is very different from normal, so it'll be a good topic for the next hour.
All right, well, this is X Squared Radio. I'm Brooks Agnew. My excellent guest tonight is Lloyd Pye. His website is www.starchildproject.com, and he also has a website, lloydpye.com, and we'll get a little bit into that toward the second half of the second hour. And we'll be back after these brief messages. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in this series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to ArkOfMillionsOfYears.com. Get your autographed copy today.
now, also available in full audio version.
You own an inkjet printer, right? I used to purchase my replacement inkjet cartridges at a national superstore that will remain unnamed. A few months ago, I replaced the color and black cartridges, and the cost was nearly $80. Well, no more. Now, I purchase all my inkjet cartridge and copier supplies from 123 Inkjet. Now, I pay less than $15 per cartridge, and I got free shipping. Plus, every time I buy, I have a chance at winning a brand new printer. How cool is that? All you have to do is click on the 123 Inkjet banner at X Squared Radio, and you get exactly the same savings. Excellent printer supplies at super savings at 123 Inkjet at X Squared Radio. There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. You know, we have revealed to you the ancient predictions that natural disasters are going to increase in power and frequency in these times. We might not always have the National Weather Service or the Emergency Broadcasting Service. So you might want to get your hands on some of the best weather reporting instruments around. Visit Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio and pick up something that might be useful. They also have the neatest gift for your favorite people who like things for the outdoors or for their meditation garden. Check out Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio. One of the things we have learned here at X Squared Radio from our emails is that many listeners to this program are educators. Well, we have recently added a great affiliate for you. The Academic Superstore is the place where you can buy software, neat tools and gadgets, and even supplies such as calculators and iPod peripherals at huge discounts. The best things for the classroom and for the student are just a tax-free click away. All you have to do is click the Academic Superstore sign at X Squared Radio and start saving. You probably know Kevin Smith as one of the premier talk radio hosts in the world today. Well, now there is a new reason to know the name. His new book, Gods in the Garden. It's a shining light of truth in print that takes us back to the origins of mankind. Don't be afraid to find out who you really are and where you came from. The answer will open the windows of knowledge for you, so you can see everything for yourself. Visit his website at kevinsmithshow.com or purchase it at the online store at X Squared Radio today. Welcome back to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, and our excellent guest, Lloyd Pye. At the end of the last hour, we said we were going to start talking a little bit about the difference between the Star Child bone of the skull and human bone. And I had made the statement that human bone is pretty much the same around the globe. There are variations in density, and as we get older, we suffer from osteoporosis and various things like that. And our bones do better if we do a little bit of weight training, and of course we take calcium. But the range of density of human bone is within limits, and we require a certain amount of thickness to be able to bear our weight or to be able to handle athletic activities, and our bones do break, and they have to be mended. But the Star Child skeletal construction was quite a bit different than human, and maybe that's what we can discuss now. What did we find that was different about it?
Well, the first thing right off the bat, if you hold the human skull that was found with the Star Child, right away, instantly, you notice the Star Child weighs half as much. It just feels like a dried gourd in your hand compared to a melon in the other. It's very, very weird to look at a skull that's really exactly the same size, volume-wise, as the human one. I mean, they're both about 15 centimeters by 15 centimeters by 15 centimeters, so you're looking at two skulls that are essentially the same in terms of external size, and yet one weighs half of the, what the other one weighs. So that's way outside the normal perimeter for a human skull. Now, not only that, the Star Child's bone is uniformly half the thickness of the human skull, or half as thick as it ought to be, all over it, every bit of it. This isn't a situation where there was, say, hydrocephalic pressure inside the brain and it caused a bulge, and so that bulge area is thin. Every bit of the bone is thin relative to what it should be. So it's like there. I'm sorry?
No, go ahead.
Okay, I'm hearing a little bit of a backwash. So it's half as thick as it ought to be all the way around, which is extremely unusual because, again, that there's no known deformity that creates that. So it's half as thick as it ought to be. It weighs half as much as it ought to weigh. And then, finally, when we got it in the lab and started doing the cutting on it, the geneticist informed me that it was two or three times as hard as it ought to be. It was very, very durable to the blade and resisting the cutting blades. So here you've got this thin little bone, this light little bone that they thought was just going to, bust open like an eggshell pretty much. And boy, they could hardly put the Dremel blade through it. Had to really struggle to do that.
So it was lightweight but very strong.
Exactly. So that was a real puzzle for a while, and when the geneticists, when we came up empty with those seven tests on the nuclear DNA, and they said you're looking at a 3 to 5 year wait to have another shot at it. In the meanwhile, you really ought to check into the biochemistry of this bone because this is not like normal bone. Now, not only was it difficult to cut, listen to this. When you get normal human bone and you're wanting to do the kind of DNA extraction that they were going to do, the first thing you do is you put the bone in a test tube in a liquid called EDTA, which is a dissolving substance, and you put it on a rocker, which is something that just, if you had a biology degree, you know what a rocker is, a test tube rocker, just rocking it back and forth and sloshing it around in there, and you do that, and about a week, the bone's gone, it's dissolved into the EDTA, and it's ready to, they're ready to start working on it. The Star Child, EDTA had no effect on the Star Child bone, whatever, as long as they left it in the rockers. They had to add something else called Tween 20, which is a very strong detergent to dissolve it out. So, right again, another thing indicating very clearly it's not like human bone.
So in that cutting process later, when we began to examine it under scanning electron microscopes, a scanning electron microscope, we found that lo and behold, embedded in the matrix of the bone itself is some kind of weird fiber-looking things. We don't really know what they are. But those fibers seem to be very durable, because if you go to the website and you look at the pictures that were taken with the scanning electron microscope, you can see that while they are shredded, they are not cut off flush. While their ends are shredded, they are not cut off flush with the bone, meaning they resisted the Dremel blade. They resisted the cutting power of the Dremel blade. Now that tells you that those fibers are very durable, whatever they are, and it could be that they are what add to, you know, give the extra strength, the extra durability to the bone. We don't know. We just make that as kind of a working assumption.
You think the spider webs were a little like the fibers were a little like spider web?
No, they're thicker than that. I mean, they're microscopic in size relative to just you and me sitting here. They're very, very small. But still, relative to the bone, they're very visible. All you have to do is just, you know, go to the site and you can see them, and you'll see what the proportion of them are. They're relative to the bone itself. So they're not like spider webs. They're thicker than that, but they're there, and they're durable.
Like
so
fibrous reinforcement.
It could be, but it doesn't seem to be like in a regular pattern. That's one of the things that's puzzling about it. And in fact, they don't even all seem to be the same kind of things. They don't even seem to be the same kind of fibers. So the first thing, our first thought was that maybe these are something grown onto the bone after the fact. So we took them to a group of scientists called mycologists, who are the ones who study, you know, bacteria and fungi and molds and things like that. And they, while there are 30,000 possibilities, these are three of the top guys in England, couldn't come up with anything remotely like it, because you can see in the pictures it's embedded in the bone. It's coming right out of the bone. It isn't like something grown on like a mold or something. It's in the bone, and each piece of it is very finite and very contained within itself. And that just that's not what the standard mycologists expected to see, and so they do not think that that's what it is. They don't know what it is.
Something like a fungal root or something that bored its way into the bone. This is actually
integral.
Yeah,
but that's the whole point is they weren't exposed. They'd have to be through the whole matrix of the bone. In the matrix of the bone.
Mm-hmm.
So how would they get in there? Because they're not coming out of the cancellous holes necessarily. They're coming out of the cortical layer. And that's the hard part. And also, too, keep in mind that we found that the collagen amount, this is really interesting, you know, is while the bone itself is half as thick as it ought to be, the collagen in there is what it ought to be for the full amount, the full depth. It's like there's been a compression program, like you run a compression program on your computer. There's been a compression program run on the collagen in the Star Child's bone to keep all the collagen in there while compressing the bone to half the size of normal. And so it gives it sort of kind of a consistency more like tooth enamel than regular bone in places. So that's pretty interesting. And then later within the cancellous holes, bone is the way flat bone like that, like skull bone, is laid out is kind of like a sandwich, in that you have the two loaves of bread on top are the thick, solid bone, the cortical layers, and within, between, like the middle of the sandwich, is the cancellous holes where the marrow moves.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the cancellous holes, which should be, by all rights and by all normalcy, and the normal human one was like this, they should be absolutely whistle clean, because when you die, you have bacteria in your body that reduce you to nothing, that eat your skin, eat your muscles, just, you know, you rot, you decompose. Mother Nature cleans her plate. And in fact, in normal circumstances, your bones will be dissolved as well by, again, bacteria, molds, fungi, things like that are out in the woods, out in normal course of events. That's how all animals that die out in the open, that's how they they go away to nothing eventually. So with this, the normal human bone had its cancellous holes just whistle clean. Those bugs had cleaned it out as they were supposed to do when the being died. But with the star child, something was left behind in the cancellous hole, some red residue that we don't know what it is either. We just don't know what it is. So these are the kinds of things that science needs to determine. We know they're there. And so when I was in England and these things first came up, I had the interesting experience of trying to interest them in it, the mainstream news media over there. And they would have none of it. They weren't interested because it wasn't an official study. It wasn't done under the auspices of Oxford University or Cambridge University with all of the, you know, what they call the boffins over there. That's their term for the bigwigs, scientific bigwigs, the boffins. And so because the boffins weren't really involved, they weren't interested. And so part of what I'm expecting and hoping the book will do and the National Geographic program will do is to bring these things out to the world, that this is what's in this bone and this is what needs to be resolved. What are these things? You know, what are they? And science needs to get on the stick and initiate a program of discovery about this in the same way that they initiated the program of discovery about Otzi, the Neolithic man, and let's just find out. Let's let the chips fall where they may. Let's find out what it really is.
Well, that's what I say. You know, we have all kinds of tests that we do, and preliminary ones are qualitative, like what is it soluble in, what is the melting temperature of it, what is the hardness, and just that preliminary information tells me that you've got different chemical composition, at least different protein structure. I don't know if these red fibers are protein or not. They probably are, but they've got a lot of iron in them if they're putting off a red color, which isn't what you normally find in human bone. You find primarily calcium, which is a much weaker metal. But it's a clear sign that of many millennial or natural selection in the heavy gravity environments or the evidence of fantastic genetic engineering, don't you think?
Well, it's certainly nothing that is normal on Earth. That much I can tell you. As far as the iron being a major component of the red stuff, you could well be right. We don't know, because there, one of the problems when this stuff was first being found by the scientists who were doing the work is that, and the mycologists included, there's no protocols for recovering these things and studying them because they've never been seen before. So
right.
there's no test, there's no equipment, there's no tools, there's no nothing for right now recovery and testing. However, as they said, you know, if we can design pipettes to pull out a single sperm and insert that into an egg, we can do this. But we have to have the money to pay for the time and the trouble to create the protocols to do the testing. So this is where science has to have a will to do this.
Mm-hmm.
In order to come up with the money to pay for it, because certainly we can't do it out of our own pockets. This is, you know, we're talking serious cheese here, and so somebody's got to step up and handle it, and that's what the book is for, is to get the word. And now the National Geographic thing, which was a fortuitous event just out of the blue, to bring it to public attention and hopefully get the kind of participation that we require.
Well, you have that kind of mainstream publicity in your court. Now maybe you qualify for some National Science Foundation money. And
no, that's not going to happen until scientists step forward willing to assume the responsibility of this. They're certainly not going to give me any money because I'm not qualified to do any of the testing. I'm just sort of the overseer here and the cheerleader.
Well,
I'm not technically qualified, so it's going to require somebody, some group of scientists probably, to step forward and say, we will take responsibility for this. Now, the problem there for them is it's a career killer. If they're wrong, if they, you know, if they do this, none of their peers want this done. You know, it's going to be extremely difficult to find scientists with cojones big enough to step up and take this on openly, publicly. I've been trying to do it for years, and I've gotten about a handful, you know, over the years, who are willing to put their names to it. So it isn't an easy thing to do. If it was, it would have been done a long time
ago. Sure, sure, I see that. Now, this bone being, you know, lighter in weight and stronger, was it thinner than normal bone, the skull itself, and so that this being had a greater than normal brain size?
Absolutely.
For being,
yeah, the bone is, like I said, uniformly throughout, it's half as thick as it ought to be, which indeed does. But there are other things too. Keep in mind, these numbers are going to stagger you, so keep these things in mind. You have the head shape the same approximate volume as the human skull found with it, about 15 cubic centimeters.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So that being said, the parietals are much larger than they are in human. The parietals meaning the upper rear part of the head,
mm-hmm.
much bigger. There is no frontal sinus at all in the skull, so that's a lot
that makes room
that humans would take up. The eye sockets are much shallower than they would be, so that's less room in the skull taken up by the star child. So with the human brain of that size, of a person that size, which is about a 5-foot-tall human being, that's what the human is, that skull holds about 1,200 cubic centimeters of volume of brain, 1,200 cubic centimeters of brain.
That's a normal human.
No, that's a normal, small-statured human.
Oh,
that's
about a normal
12-year-old.
I see.
You know, Mexicans of that era and of this era today, 5 feet is not an unusual height at all.
Right.
For Mexicans today. So that's how she was, about in the range of 5 feet tall, based on the size of her head. So she had about a 1,200 cubic centimeter brain. You and I, average people of average height, have 1,400 cubic centimeters, so it's fully 200 cubic centimeters more to in a normal human brain, about 1,400 cubic centimeters.
Not that we use it.
Not that we use it, but it's there. So the star child has a brain volume capacity of 1,600 cubic centimeters. So that should be 1,200 cubic centimeters approximately in there, give or take. But again, we have those additional factors of no sinus, very shallow eye sockets, realigned, redesigned parietals, and uniform thinness of the bone overall. But it still doesn't seem to be enough to account for 400 cubic centimeters, because we're talking, remember, 1,200 cubic centimeters is what she has, and that's the same size that skull is. It's slightly smaller than yours or mine. But that doesn't account for 400, fully one-third more. Keep in mind, you know, one-third more brain tacked in there somehow.
Mm.
We don't really see how the thinness, the lack of the sinuses, and the shallowness of the eye sockets and the expansion of the parietals accounts for that much extra brain. And yet there it is. I mean, there's no question when you pour the flaxseed in, that's what you get as a measurement. So it's just a puzzle. It's wall-to-wall brain in there. There's no doubt about it. It's got as much brain packed into that skull as you can possibly put in there. And
I would be very interested to see if we could ever find the village that this being settled in or died in, what kind of effect a being with that kind of cranial capacity would have on that community. You know, we see the effect of Einstein's or Leonardo da Vinci's or Newton's in a community like that. When you have a being with that kind of capacity there, you just know there's going to be some kind of effect.
Well, that presupposes, Brooks, that it was able to speak.
Ah.
And we can't really say that, because if you look at its neck, and let's just talk about the neck for a moment here. Its neck is completely different than a normal human neck. Its foramen magnum has been shifted forward a little over an inch forward so that it's dead center up under the skull rather than to the rear of the skull like a normal human spine enters.
So it might not have had vocal cords.
And so, yeah, the neck itself is about one half to maybe one third. We don't really know, but it's greatly reduced relative to a normal human neck. And it's positioned in a completely different way. So if the spine is coming up the middle of the neck is what it kind of looks like, and did it really have a voice in the way that we think? Did it have room for that? Or if it did, what kind of voice would it have? And also keep in mind, here's another interesting thought, and this came out to me during the course of this research. The sinuses are missing, right? What do you think your sinuses are good for? What's the main primary use of your sinuses other than giving you the devil when you're sick with a cold or you have a hay fever or whatever?
Well, it's to prevent germs from getting into the body.
Absolutely wrong. What has no effect on that whatsoever, according to my, what I've been told. What your sinuses really do is they allow your voice to resonate.
Oh.
And if you take away the sign, if you took away the sinuses, we would all be talking like this, and it would be very weird relative to what it normally is. But you hear somebody with missing sinuses.
An African gray parrot doesn't have much of sinuses, but it can speak fairly clearly.
Well, but that's a function of the throat. But still, nonetheless, I'm just giving you, you're right. I mean, they can do wonderful things. But I'm just giving you what was told to me, that really we don't need our sinuses. They're like our appendix. They're sort of except for the resonant capacity of the voice, which was a surprise to me. So if you take away the sinuses from the star child, maybe it didn't speak at all and it didn't have sinuses because it didn't need to speak.
Yeah,
and maybe that big brain was just for, for just transmitting its thoughts to people.
Mm. Now, the being that was in the cave with the hand wrapped around the arm of the star child.
No, wrong. Keep in mind, the human being. There are two skulls. One is human, clearly human, and the other one is the star child. The human being was lying on the dirt. The star child was buried. She had buried him. Now let's talk about that scenario for a minute. The star child had clearly died. Whether she killed it or whether it died, we don't know and we have no way to know. But we do know that she had enough feeling for it or affection for it or commitment to it or something that she buried it in that mine tunnel and then she laid down and committed suicide beside it. Because that scenario, as described by that girl, is hard to imagine any other thing.
Yeah.
It died, she buried it, then she laid down on top of the dirt, nobody to bury her, and left its hand sticking up out of the dirt to wrap around her arm to show her affection and commitment to it or whatever. And not that she was showing it to anybody, because by burying herself in that mine tunnel, she probably wasn't ever expecting to be found. But in any case, the scenario as described can only be a death and a suicide, or a murder and a suicide.
Mm.
So.
And this was not the being's mother.
No, it was not the being's mother. We got her mitochondrial DNA and her nuclear DNA. Boom. First test, easy, very easy to see and find, both in Vancouver, by the way, and in California with the other one.
Huh.
So her DNA is what we expected the star childs to be. Very easy to recover because, again, they were 900 years in a mine tunnel. There should be no degradation to speak of. And the star child was buried, so he's got even more reason to have his DNA easily recoverable and his mitochondrial DNA, mitochondrial DNA really was easy to recover. It's
so
the
she
nuclear
wasn't related.
DNA.
She wasn't
is,
related in any way. She was just committed.
No,
she's
haplogroup C. The star child was haplogroup A. She's haplogroup C. Two completely different biological tribes, groups. And so there, you know, in other words, if it was, if she was its mother, we, if they had both been haplogroup A or they had both been haplogroup C, that would have been a strong indication she was his mother. But we still couldn't have proved it based on that. You see what I mean?
But they obviously had some kind of relationship, either as, like, as you said, either close
she was
friend.
Either she was either a caretaker, she was a lover, she was a friend. We don't know what, but she obviously had a strong attachment to it, to the star child, because when it demised, however it did, she was willing to go with it. So that's an awful lot of sincerity there.
Certainly is. Well, do you think the world is ready to hear that that there was an alien hybrid on the Earth that lived 900 years ago?
Well, up to now, to be honest with you, Brooks, the world has not been, because every time we've put it out there, it's just quietly been swept under the rug. We're hoping that the level of recognition that the National Geographic will give it will, you know, cause a real change in that. And certainly we're hoping that if we get a major deal out of a major publisher, you know, Random House or Simon & Schuster or one of the really big ones, and
well,
that they will
have distribution.
Put some serious money behind it, exactly, to advertise it and distribute it and put it out in the bookstores and you know, pay for a promotion tour that'll allow people to know it's out there.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, in conjunction with the National Geographic thing, that has become much more of a possibility. You see what I mean?
Yes, I
Before,
do.
I was beginning to despair whether we would get a real good quality book deal, but now with the National Geographic thing online, that certainly is going to be tempting to mainstream publishers to get involved, because there will be that many people out there aware of it, and it's just a function of making that many more people aware of it, because a lot of people are going to want to find out more about it.
Yeah, I talk to a lot of people, and when you say things like about the Star Child or giants or anything else like that, people say, well, how come I've never heard about that? How come I haven't seen one in a museum? How come I haven't seen it on television? Well, now they're about to.
Right. Well, it could well be that this will be the tipping point that I've been hoping for these 7 years, you know, that something would happen, and it feels like this is as good an opportunity as we're going to get. So,
one of the things that it does, you know, as wonderful as this project is, and as large in scope as it appears on this program, is it's just a pinhole. Opening into a segue into this intervention theory that you purport so strongly and so eloquently. And it's different than creationism or evolution or even intelligent design. Can you, in our final half hour here, you're going to have to travel, I understand, so you're only going to be with us for a couple of hours, but I did want to see if we could get into this intervention theory and see, you know, in a nutshell, why is it different than, say, intelligent design?
Well, because relative to intelligent design or creationism or Darwinism, we have, in the intervention theory movement, believe that there has been intervention on planet Earth, but not necessarily from a big G God. You know, not from an anthropomorphic god of religion, but multiple gods, small g, super beings on Earth, who came here and developed life as we know it here on Earth. Now, there are two realms of it. There's the initial development of life on Earth, and then there is the subsequent development of life on Earth. And those are two very different periods, and two very different things went on. Back in the initial establishing of life on Earth goes back about 4 billion years.
Wow.
Billion years. And suddenly, while the Earth is still basically just congealing itself into the planet as we know it, it's supposedly just seething magma and, you know, very little or no land to speak of, or water or seas, or just lava, just a ball of seething lava. And on that seemingly impossible surface and terrain, you have out of the blue two different kinds of prokaryotic bacteria, the archaea and the true bacteria, and they appear simultaneously, and they appear in numbers, different kinds, and they appear, you know, complete. They're ready to go. They didn't just evolve. They clearly came here. Now, you can argue, how did that happen? Panspermia is one theory, that where it's just accidentally, they just floated in on a meteorite or something, or directed panspermia, meaning somebody, you know, shot them here from a rocket, some other galaxy or something. And you know, it's just a lot easier to assume that somebody just came along whose job it is to do this, saw a solar system forming, and went along and sprinkled life that could survive in any environment on every one of the incipient planets, and said, well, we'll come back in a, you know, few million years and see how things are going. And that's what seemed to happen, because the archaea and the true bacteria appear at around 4 billion years ago, and they are all there is for about 2 billion years. And then suddenly, once they, by the action of their bodies, now, remember, these are the extremophiles. These are the ones that can live in absolutely anything. They're indestructible. So they established themselves on Earth, and they sort of began to put oxygen into the atmosphere, and particularly into the water. And when it was to a certain point, and it had cooled down enough after a couple of billion years, a new type of single-celled creature was brought on, the eukaryotes. You got the prokaryotes and the eukaryotes. The eukaryotes have now got a cell nucleus. But again, there's no way for them to construct themselves. They're so complex relative to the prokaryotes. Science tries to say that, well, somehow the larger prokaryotes ate some of the smaller prokaryotes, and somehow those smaller prokaryotes in the bodies of the larger prokaryotes turned into the cell nucleus. And I mean, the things they go through to try to explain this impossibility is just, it's laughable.
Yeah, they won't accept the idea of irreducible complexity.
Exactly. Well, they can't do that, because that opens the door to having to teach alternative theories in class, and science wants to believe that they have it down, they're absolutely right, and that there's no alternative, when there clearly is. So, I mean, I'm not for teaching religion in classrooms, but I'm certainly for teaching alternative theories, because, you know, irreducible complexity of intelligent design is worth teaching, is worth knowing, is worth trying to understand. But so is just straight out intervention, because
think
really the evidence is much more on our side than it is the intelligent design craft. And I believe in the end, over time, 100 years from now, 200 years from now, people are going to look back on the time we're living right now, Brooks, and they're going to say, yes, these intervention people were the ones who had their finger on it. This is the way it really was and is. So it's just going to take time to get our message out there to a level that enough people see it and understand the logic and the wisdom of it, I think.
Well, we have to make one fundamental jump as a race. We have to admit that we are not alone in the universe.
Right. That's exactly
and
it.
And we're not even fairly advanced in
exactly
the universe.
Exactly that.
Once we make that jump, then it's pretty easy to
right.
say, you know, somebody intervened in
life
development.
Well, something is going to cause that precipitation. If, you know, a UFO landing on the White House lawn, or the star child being proved out as what we think it is, or, you know, something like that. There's going to be this event that's going to make it all undeniable from that point forward. And once we start looking for answers in the right places, once we drop Darwinism, once we drop creationism, once we get ourselves pointed in the right direction, we'll start finding answers that will have validity and will be ultimately true in the long run.
Right. Well, you said there were two points of intervention. Now we had
right.
the
well, you have the basic beginnings of life, the eukaryotes and the prokaryotes, and then from 4 billion years, skip ahead to about 500 million years ago, about half a billion years. And suddenly you have the Cambrian explosion in which very complex cellular creatures appear. The Cambrian explosion is just unexplainable in Darwinian terms, because in a period of probably about 5 million years, which to us seems very long, but it was like the snap of your fingers relative to the 3.5 billion years that have gone before, overnight you have the oceans filled with all 26 animal phyla that we have today. We had predators and prey. We had males and females. The whole panoply. It was just dumped here. A big dump truck came. A big cosmic dump truck came, and they just dumped it off in the oceans to live. You know, to make it here. And it's clear in the fossil record that not only did that happen then, but subsequently we've had 5 major extinction events, and several smaller. Not major, minor. How do you have a minor extinction event? But anyway, very bad things happened, and anywhere from 10% to 90% of all the life on Earth at that time was wiped out. And yet, when these events would happen, not long after they would occur, once the Earth would be given a few thousand or a few million years to settle out, and you've got a new environment, new everything, and suddenly there's new life here. A whole new panoply of life will appear after the extinction events. Every time when the Earth needs a new infusion of life, it gets it, and it gets stuff that can live in whatever the new environment is.
And then it all equalizes to a new ecology.
Right, exactly. And in fact, science itself knows this. They don't like to admit it. They don't like to deal with it, but it was put forth in a very compelling theory by Stephen Jay Gould, one of the leading lights before he died, and Niles Eldridge, called punctuated equilibrium. And that is essentially an acknowledgement, a full and open acknowledgement of the reality that the fossil record makes clear, that Darwinism, the steady gradualism of Darwinism, just doesn't happen. It doesn't exist.
No.
There is no real gradual movement forward in an evolutionary sense from one thing to another thing to another thing to another thing. That is absolutely absent in the fossil record. What is visible is these sudden leaps, these sudden jumps forward. So they came up with a scientific way to try to explain it that they called punctuated equilibrium, that most scientists absolutely rejected and hated them for doing, because it was stating the obvious. And still to this day, you get a lot of heat about punctuated equilibrium, but it's very true and it's very clear.
Yeah, and it not only, from what I understand, happened in the animal world, it also happened in the plant world.
In the plant world, exactly. The development of flowering plants came out of nowhere. Darwin himself called them the great abomination or something like that. You know, how do you explain them? You have no precursors, and then suddenly, boom, you have flowering plants all over the place. So it's all clear that somebody is overseeing the development of life on this planet. And then we get to, once we have just those creatures and dinosaurs and everything else that go along in there, for what reason, I don't know, but there they were. Then you have clear and present development of life on Earth as we know it, because you have the domesticated plants and animals, all of which stand apart from creatures of the wild, and you have human beings who really stand apart from anything else on the earth.
Sure.
And we all, domesticated plants and animals and ourselves, bear the handiwork of genetic manipulation in our genes.
Mm-hmm.
And when you really study that and you see how clear the evidence is, that human beings have been genetically manipulated, created, and that domesticated plants and animals have been genetically created, it really becomes obvious that if the program is going on now, within fairly recent history, the last, say, couple of 100,000 years, to create us and to create the domesticated plants and animals, then you have to assume that, well, then it could be it goes all the way back 4 billion years and beyond. And that's what intervention theory is fundamentally about, trying to figure out who, the whos, the whys, the wherefores of the clear interventions that have occurred on the Earth since the very beginning.
So if you want to make an intelligent jump, you could say that a long period of very meticulous laying down of one life form after another to form either mineral or protein precursors that are necessary for the next generation, like fossil fuels or fungi or grasses being available for higher animals, or all of these things. It was a very deliberate design, and they come from time to time with their whatever stockpiles they use. I don't know if it be space blimps or space arcs full of this life, and they deposit it here and let it take off by design. And they pretty much know what that life is going to equilibrate to on this planet.
Well, I don't know if it's that well designed and that well thought out, Brooks. When you really look at it, it's more like a general program. Here's how I see it, and I've studied it an awful lot. I see it as sort of a general program at work in the universe, and maybe in other universes, but certainly in the universe and in other galaxies. What you have is a program that seems to be just generally applied to any new solar system that's forming anywhere. This is the vision that I have of it. And life is just sprinkled out there to do the best it can, because they don't really know when a place is just forming where the zone of life is going to end up. So any planet out there, or planetoid or planetesimal, is going to get a dose of that invulnerable prokaryotic life forms, the ones that can just endure anything, the extremophiles.
Do you think they come back from time to time?
Yeah, and then they'll come back and see, where did they root? Where are they changing the atmosphere? Where are they putting oxygen? Where are they making it habitable for higher species? And when they see that, then they nurture that along. Like, you know, I don't know that there was one visit at 4 billion years ago, and then the next visit was 2 billion years ago when the eukaryotes came. I don't know that. I do know that the prokaryotes had changed the atmosphere of the Earth tremendously in those 2 billion years by virtue of their life processes producing oxygen, you know, consuming iron, one of the things that they did, tying up all the loose iron that would combine with the oxygen and everything, you know, like on Mars. The first thing you do if you're going to build a planet is you've got to tie up the loose iron. Because
yeah,
the iron will soak up
the
oxygen,
to get the oxygen,
right?
Out of it, right?
So you got to make rust and rust everything out, so that it'll stop consuming the oxygen, and you can have a surplus of oxygen. So that, you know, that happened, and the eukaryotes, we were ready for the eukaryotes around 2 billion years ago, and there they came. You know, there they appear. And they are much bigger and much more powerful engines of production for oxygen. And so in another 1.5 billion years for them, working alongside the prokaryotes, of course, these new engines of producing oxygen had saturated the seas to a point where the Cambrian explosion could occur. And you could have very, very sophisticated higher life forms brought in, relatively speaking, compared to the eukaryotes, and you got that. And so that's the Cambrian explosion. And then everything subsequent to that, up to the last couple of 100,000 years, let's say, I don't really know what they were doing bringing the life forms that they did, but it was advancing some program that is not really clear. Why dinosaurs? You know, why anything other than the sophisticated primates, us, that eventually have taken over. But if you look at that, we've not been very good marshals of the planet, you know, that we were put in charge of. So maybe we're a failed experiment, or an experiment in process that is not doing very well. I don't really know. Those things we don't know. What we need to be able to focus on is the fact of intervention itself. If we can just get that established and start looking for these answers and looking for these plausible reasons then who knows? Maybe if those who are doing it see that we're acknowledging their existence and their presence, and we're genuinely seeking, you know, true answers, maybe they'll come forward and say, okay, you're to a point now where you're ready to deal with this, and we're going to now explain it to you. And, you know, that could happen possibly within our lifetimes.
That's one thing leads to another, and there is a I'm going to say there's a global apprehension. People that I interview and that write to me from all over the world, they say, you know, something. We don't have any concrete proof. We don't have any telepathic messages. I don't have any UFOs landing in my front yard giving me this message, but I feel like something grand and marvelous is about to happen, that we're about to be introduced to the galactic community. And hopefully we don't see that as a clear and present danger and start some kind of war with them, as we're prone to do. But
that would be just the most colossal blunder. I don't see how we can have a war with somebody. I mean, we're like, what, blind in one hand, tied behind our back, you know, compared to them. I don't really see that.
I don't either, but I'm former military. I haven't spent a lot of time in the Air Force, but enough time around military people that to know that anything that can fly faster, higher, and defend itself harmlessly against anything we can throw at it is automatically seen as a clear and present danger. And unless there's some very high up diplomatic and informed sources in our government saying, okay, boys, put your weapons down, it's time to talk, I think that we will see skirmishes like that. And speaking to some of the experts around the world, not the least of which is Dr. Stephen Greer, there have been incidents where we've shot down their craft and they have shot down our craft. And I don't know if these are the people that are actually intervening. Like you say, I would expect to see, you know, ships full of finished product that they can dump into the ocean and say, you know, multiply and replenish the sea, not frozen DNA. I don't think that's going to do any good. You're going to have to bring a finished animal here or sets of animals and then tell them to procreate or turn them loose.
Right. Well, I mean, absolutely, I do believe that there have been attempts by us to shoot them down and maybe some successes and vice versa. But, you know, I don't know if they're the ones who created us. I don't know if they're the ones who are the bosses, you know, the uber bosses of the universe, the ones who did it from 4 billion years ago. They could just be local thugs, for all we know, who are scouting the territory. I mean, you know, I see it as very complex out there. If you look at the reports of people who have encounters with aliens, there are like 7 or 8 basic kinds right now, minimum, and it could be more than that. So they could have a history not much different than ours, and they could be anywhere from a few hundred to a few thousand years ahead of us, mm-hmm. if that. But the big ones, the ones that started it in the first place 4 billion years ago, obviously they are the true super beings, the true gods. And they would have no concept of time. I don't think death would mean anything to them. And they would, I don't think we could lay a glove on them. So it's a question of what level we're actually interacting with when comes.
You say the National Geographic special is going to come out sometime in October.
Well, late October is what they said, yeah.
About that time is also the Sundance Film Festival, and there is a film, a digital film that's been done by John Gress with Jaguar Films, excellent digital special effects studio, and it's going to probably debut during that film festival as well, and it's called One Anunnaki, and he's done a tremendous amount of research on this, and it's the first of 3 movies that are coming out, and there are a lot of people waiting to see this movie, and it may set the stage for even greater drama behind what we're talking about tonight.
No kidding. Well, listen, seriously, you've got my email address. Would you email me that information? Because what I'd like to do is forward that to the National Geographic people and see when the Sundance Festival is, and maybe they would want to tie in with that.
Oh,
because
that'd be great.
Sitchin is one of the people that they've interviewed, you know.
Ah, well, John's going to be on X Squared Radio on the 23rd, so you can catch that show, and I will definitely send you the information.
I just need the date of the Sundance.
The film festival?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, I can do that.
And you know, something to show that it's really going to be on there. I don't want to send the National Geographic people bad information, but yeah, that would probably be useful for them to know.
Yeah, well, I know it's in post production right now. They're doing the landscapes, which all have to be, you know, done digitally, and I think they're well on their way to getting that finished.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a big, exciting thing. You know, John is, Jaguar Films is a very, very fine digital studio anyway, and special effects for major motion pictures.
Uh-huh.
And this is, I think, the first digital independent film. All is no film to it. It's all done by digital cameras.
The characters are digital?
No, the people are real actors, but it's all filmed with digital cameras. There's
so it's all blue screen with the actors, and everything behind them is digital.
Some actual landscape, some on-site underwater digital photography, which I don't think has been done very much. There's a lot of new things in this movie, and I expect to learn a lot more on the 23rd. But the fact that we are now talking about the Anunnaki, and we're talking about, you know, super beings coming to the Earth and sprinkling life upon it, we are about to have an amazing metamorphosis in literature, both film, radio, and print, and it's going to be an awesome time to be alive.
I agree. I absolutely agree, and I'm excited that, you know, people like us are having a major role in that. It's very exciting.
I don't know how major X Squared Radio is, but we do our piece. I think we are growing, and that's a good sign. You're either
right.
Green and growing or ripe and rotten, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, good for you, and keep it going.
Well, I appreciate you being on the program. It's been absolutely fascinating, and I'm looking forward to having you back on, and I'm definitely going to pick up your book, and if you don't mind, I'll put it in the online store on X Squared Radio so people can buy it from there. Or if, are you going to have a book at Amazon finally?
No. The Star Child book will be, but I don't believe that Everything You Know Is Wrong will probably ever be there. It might be. I don't know. If it's reprinted, I think we're going to reprint it pretty soon, and maybe the reprint will be there, but the original probably never will be. It annoyed somebody at Amazon, and they just wanted to make sure it got off and stayed off. So
yeah,
I don't.
That's quite possible.
I don't know what you can do when you get somebody. You know, it's a big corporation, but they are people, and they do have feelings. And if you get real conservative fundamentals in the right position, they can do you some damage. So that seems to be what happened.
Yes. Well, listen, I've appreciated you being on the program. Thank you very much for the 2 hours.
Thanks, Brooks, very much, and I'll look forward to doing it again sometime in the future.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Good night. X Squared Radio here, Brooks Agnew. We have another hour. I did want to let you know that. It's going to be open lines, 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Nothing but me and you for the next hour. I am going to play a little bit of commercial here, and then we will be right back with more of X Squared Radio. Did you know that 11 of the 12 sets of footprints on the moon were made by Eagle Scouts? It's true. Soon, men and women will be doing the real moonwalk. But just so we don't forget, the first footprint on the moon has been replicated,
in a limited edition plaque that would make the perfect gift for a court of honor. Maybe you need something special for your office or your library at home. This high-quality plaque can add that something special that lets people know how excited you are. We are returning to the moon. Visit Countdown Creations at X Squared Radio today and order your limited edition First Step on the Moon plaque. Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They've come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio.
You know, thus is the place where the past meets the future. If you have done your genealogy and found that you have roots in the Irish or Scottish clans, then don't you think it would be a great idea to have a replica of your family crest? You can get a coat of arms, a ring, or even a family tartan that may help you or your grandchildren remember your ancestors. This is the time when the hearts of the children are turned to the hearts of the fathers. We only carry the best. So if you're ready to experience the glory of your past, you're ready to visit Scottish Heirlooms at X Squared Radio.
People are always looking for something inexpensive and unique. Give people they love. Well, now there is a way to give a gift that not only says how long you will love them, but it also allows you to help keep the planet green and growing. Tree Givers at X Squared Radio is the company that will plant a tree on public lands somewhere in the 50 states and provide your special person with a beautiful certificate of that placement. This has become one of the most popular gift sites in the world. And because of their love for the Earth, they are changing the world. So visit Tree Givers at X Squared Radio and see if you can find a gift for your special person. The space shuttle fleet is very soon going to be retired. No other spacecraft in history has advanced the world more than this fleet. I wanted a way to keep that memory alive in my home, so I went to the space store and ordered a 25-inch model of the Space Orbiter. People who have seen it always comment on the incredible attention to detail in this model. If you know someone who loves the space program and you want to get them a gift that they will never forget, you should visit the Space Store at X Squared Radio. Brooks Agnew here with X Squared Radio. If you like wildlife art and would love to add some of the most beautiful replicas to your home or office, you should visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio. They have everything from pandas to fish to eagles to horses in all sizes and price ranges. No matter what animal you love, they have the art for you. So visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio for that special someone today.
Come on, 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 come on
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. This is where the past meets the future. Open lines this hour. I don't have a guest lined up, but I'm all you need if you want to call in. The number is 877-876-5227. Nothing here but you and me, and you can call in. We'll talk about just about anything. But I want to discuss with you in this opening part of this third hour, the philosophy of X Squared Radio, why we do what we do, why I find the guests that I do and bring them on and we talk about these things. In the world of paranormal radio, which is for a long time been a very small segment of entertainment world, when we talk about paranormal, people often raise their eyebrows. But in the last 6 months, we have been making a difference. I started out with a single hour on Wednesday nights. My good friend Don Newsom was kind enough to let me try my wear at it. Since that time, we have expanded, and now we're a full 3 hours every Sunday evening from 6 to 9 Eastern. I don't know what it is about the fans of this program, but you write me by the hundreds. I try to answer every single one of them. If I haven't answered you, please write back. You're signing up for the newsletter, and I'm trying to send that out as often as I can each month. And what we're trying to accomplish here is something maybe that's never been done before, or maybe it's been tried and given up. It's gotten too commercial. I know there have been other radio programs out there that have come on and tried to talk to you and tried to bring on good guests and tried to be entertaining for you, but my philosophy is I'm going to try to make this program a little more than entertaining. Yes, we're going to have the best guests on the planet on here, and we're going to try to bring you premier items like the Anunnaki interview movie and like Brent Miller with remote viewing. And I'm going to be fairly discriminating with the subject material. You notice that we haven't talked about ghosts or goblins or evil spirits. That's by design. I'm trying to see if I can build this genre without going down that road. I often say that everything we do will eventually affect the universe, and I mean that. I mean that we are eternal beings having a mortal experience. And although we might live 50 years, 70 years, 100 years, some of that will be productive, some of it won't be. The moment that we exert our will, that we make our mark on the universe, on time, on the earth, we do affect the universe. We affect the universe by how we treat each other. We affect the universe by the jobs that we do and the things that we put our labors into, and also the things that we don't do, our restraint, our ability to lay arms down and talk things out and forgive and be tolerant of one another. This is more or less the philosophy of X Squared Radio. We're going to try to bring you the very best spirit that we can, the very best knowledge. We're going to try to open your imagination like a ball of light, and we're going to try to let it shine as much as we can. We do like to talk about UFOs, and that is my personal preference. I am trying to find the hardest evidence that I can. I'm going to let you know that August 17th through 20th, possibly the 21st, I will be traveling up to the sanctuary in and around the James Gilliland Ranch, and I'm going to try have an experience I've never had before. I don't know what it's going to be like, but I'm going to do a live broadcast that evening of the 20th if I can, and I'm going to try to bring to you my my feelings, my observations after that that event. I believe that UFOs are out there, but I have no concrete evidence. As I said, I'm a scientist, and when I can sample something and bring it to you, you know that I will. And we also talk about alien life forms, and we do that because it is, I think, at least scientifically preposterous to assume that we are alone in the universe, no more than I assume that I'm alone right now on the radio.
I know different, even though you're not picking up the telephone and calling in. I know you're out there because I see the gigabytes of downloads that you do from our website as you listen to the archives, and I appreciate it. And hopefully I'm bringing you good enough quality that you can continue to do that. We also like to talk about ancient civilizations, and we do that for a couple of reasons. A, because it becomes obvious with a little bit of observation that historians only recorded the things that they wanted to record. In other words, only the winners record history. But in sometimes the history that they record, the things that they say define the things that they left out. For instance, when we say that the Egyptians are no more than 3,500 years old, and yet we see the works of their hands much older than that, and the engineering that it took to build those works much older than that, the things that are said outline or define the things that are not said, and we're able to explore those things. And we put that in our books too, The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 1 and Volume 2. I have not had a single complaint from people that have read that book. And they're not the easiest books in the world to read, and I apologize for that. It's more or less my writing style and EJ's writing style. But the third book, I promise you, will be a cliffhanger, and I'm going to give you some more details on that in about 15 minutes. We also talk about, we have touched on it in the early shows, and we're going to get back into it as soon as I can find some credible guests on it. And that is the human god theory. I don't really know how to put this as blandly as I can to you. The evidence is that we are not merely an evolved being. If we have evolved, it is by the design of our DNA. We are a created or a built being. And our souls are the spirits that occupy our physical bodies appear to be much, much older and bring to the table much more experience and ability than our mortal life would seem to allow. This is for a reason. Most of us believe that we are the direct offspring of God. And although I've had some guests and some of you that have written in that have said that even though we are the offspring of God, we can never become like God, I think that is a little bit of man's teaching there. If you search your heart, you'll know that to be true. I don't think that a child has any trouble becoming like its parent if it has the discipline and will to do that. And that's kind of interesting to say, that you would have will to relinquish your will to another. And That's maybe a subject for another show, but that's what I'm talking about. It boils down to what is your potential. And I meet people, I interview people on the street, believe it or not, and for this program, and I bring their thoughts and ideas to you. Most of the guests that we've had on this program are because you have suggested it. I have called them up or written them and said, hey, I have fans that are saying, or listeners to this program that are saying they would like to have you on the program. And we go after them, and we try to bring them on here. Now, there have been some that have said, no, you're not big and famous enough for me to come on your program, but maybe one day they'll regret that. I don't know. I certainly regret it. We are trying to get some very big names on here, and if I could get the President of the United States, I would get that too. I'm trying to get the CEO of Billings Energy Corporation to come on and talk about hydrogen fuel, and we may yet do that because he's an alum. But our potential is absolutely unlimited. I believe that, and I want you to believe that as well. If you listen to this program, I hope, whether you're sitting at your computer working on your project or whether you're listening live as you're driving down the road at this moment, you need to know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. You might not reach it in this mortal life, you might be stuck in a job, or you might be stuck in a marriage, or you might be stuck in a hospital bed, or in even more deplorable circumstances where you will never be able to realize your potential on this earth. I understand that, but you still need to know that you have the seeds of perfection in you. And you as an individual, there is no other. There is no other. You are the original, whatever your name is. I have a woman that wrote me a couple of excellent emails. Her name is Starlene. She's a loyal listener, and I'm sure she's going to listen to this tonight. I appreciate your emails so much because you have so much thought into them and so much feeling into them. And it seems that we're having good conversations. And there are others that have bought the book and my books and EJ's books and have given us such great thoughts and feelings. And we appreciate that. Your potential, when I say that it's absolutely unlimited, it means it goes beyond this mortal body, goes beyond your mortal mind. And that is a little bit difficult for people to grasp sometimes when you're stuck in a mundane job or you're suffering through some kind of physical illness. The interesting thing about this human body is that it's so full of so many neat sensations, and it is the vehicle through which we interpret our universe. The eyes that we have see a certain wavelength of light. That's it. We can't see much beyond the infrared, much beyond the ultraviolet, and that's it. I mean, they're pretty good spectrographic devices. The rods and cones in our eyes pick up certain wavelengths of light for a certain period of time until they become habituated, and they go blind, and so we constantly move our eyes to change that stimulation. And our brains turn the image right side up so we can see it, but that's it. That's all we get from the universe. And what we feel with our hands, a little bit of thermal information, shape, the nerve endings that are in the ends of our fingers can pick up a lot about the universe. Certainly people that don't have the use of their eyes make wonderful use of their fingers and are able to gain a lot of information about the universe that way. Hearing is another way. Just vibrations going out over the air or water, if you like to swim underwater, and they hit the little tympanic membrane in your ear, vibrate a few small bones, and send signals down the cochlea in the ear. When you're young, I guess you can hear about from 20 cycles per second up to about 20,000 cycles per second. When you're my age, it's about half that. You lose a lot of the high frequency due to loud noises. You lose some of the low frequency, and some people's voices you hear better than others. But that's basically it. I forgot a couple more, didn't I? How about taste? Yes, some of us love to taste our universe. I particularly like cheesecake. I love pepperoni pizza. And tacos, of course. And smell. And smell is probably the strongest sense that we have. You say seeing is believing. It's really not true. Smelling is believing. Smelling is the most powerful memory source the human body has. Don't ask me why that is, but I made it through organic chemistry by eating peanut butter sandwiches while I studied, and then ate a peanut butter sandwich right before taking the test. Yes, peanut butter is good brain food, but also the smell triggered all those memories, and I was able to pass organic chemistry in 8 weeks, which is not too bad for two semesters of organic chemistry. So that's it, though. That's all we can interpret of our universe. We don't see x-rays. We don't see alpha decay. We don't see any of the other frequencies of information that are out there in the universe. What does that mean? Well, it means that we're pretty blind when it comes to information in our universe. Oh, we have one other weakness, and that is that we're locked into a linear trip through time. By and large, we cannot float backward or forward in time. Oh, I suppose we can use our memory to go back in time, but even that is tainted by our own personal interpretations. It's not really what happened. It is what we interpreted happened. It's what happened while we were looking at it or listening to it. And you can prove that just by putting five people in front of a traffic accident and then having them write a report about what happened in front of their eyes. You'll get five different reports. So what actually happens is not actually what we remember in our memory. And the other direction in time, of course, is the future. Now this changes things a little bit. From our famous small friend from Star Wars fame, the future is always in motion. From a physics point of view, maybe that's not true. From a physics point of view, all possibilities actually occur. The one that we happen to travel on is just one of those futures that has occurred or will occur. If you travel back in time and change the past, you're only changing nothing. All you're doing is moving from one future to another future because that future occurred as well. Now, this is from a mathematical point of view, and it's a little bit confusing, but the human psyche is capable of moving into the future. And if you can do it well enough, and you can catch a vision of that future well enough, then you can come back to this past point, this mortal point that you're at right now, this moment, which is about 8:22 Eastern Standard Time. And in the past, you can live that path to the future. Now, this is where we reach a vision of our potential. If you really can believe that your potential is unlimited, and you can catch a vision of what that unlimited potential might be, a year from now, 4 years from now, 16 years from now, when you finish college, when you retire, when you get married, when your kids grow up and move away, if you can get a clear vision of what that moment will be like, then you should be able to get a clear vision of the moment right before it and the one right before that. I call it my but first list. When you get to the point where you think that you will be happy, or you think you'll be satisfied, or you think you'll be located, say, 5 years from now, you have to say to yourself, but first I have to do this, but first I have to do this, but first I have to do this. And work your way backwards all the way to the point where you're sitting right now listening to this broadcast. And then all you have to do is have the discipline and the guidance to walk that path that you laid out. If you walk that path and you've had a clear enough vision of where it is that you want to be or that you think you'll be happy, that's where you'll be. Now, here's the weakness in that. It's a sandcastle. Have you ever gone to the beach? When my kids and I go to the beach, we go to do serious construction projects. Not just sandcastle building. Oh, no. We take an industrial-sized bucket and a shovel. We're going to move a major amount of sand. And we set out early in the morning, and we work maybe all the way through lunch. If there's a sandcastle building contest, that's even better. Because the idea is to dig up as much sand as you can, form it into whatever you want, whether it's a Volkswagen Beetle or a dragon or a castle itself. But when the sandcastle is finished, you have a different kind of feeling. While we are working on the sandcastle, there's a joy to it. The sweat, the sun, the construction, the formation, the seeing something that you envisioned being built granule by granule or handful by handful or sloppy shovelful at a time with seashells and seawater and wind. But when the sandcastle is finished and it's time to lay the shovel down, it's time to pick the bucket up, you have a different feeling. It's not as though you've been let down. It's though you've come to a turning point. Now, you can do one of three things. You can walk away from the sandcastle. You can sit down in a chair beside it and watch the ocean come reclaim it, or you can jump on it. But all three of those choices denote that you are finished. You're done. The joy is not sitting there looking at the sandcastle. Oh, no, not at all. The joy was in building the sandcastle, you see. And life is that way. When you look into the future, make sure that this dream or this vision that you have is not a sandcastle. As I said, I ask people this question all the time. I say, what is your dream? What is your dream? Jackie told me, my dream is to marry a rich man and have a nice car. I thought, I don't know how to answer that. I really don't speak to them after I ask them what their dream is unless they can't think of what it is. But she had a clear idea of what it was. And I said to myself as I was walking away, that's a sandcastle. Because she's going to get a rich man one day, maybe, and she's going to have a nice car. And guess what? She's going to be sitting in a chair waiting for the sea to reclaim it. Because she's done. She's finished. I asked Denise, what is your dream? And she said, I want to be happy. And I said, now that is an excellent dream. That's an excellent dream. That's an open-ended dream. And it might take a variety of stimuli to reach that point of happiness. And mind you, you can't substitute pleasure for it. You can't inebriate yourself to it. You can't intoxicate yourself to it. You can't thrill yourself to it. Happiness is something that is given to you. It is not something that you can give yourself. Pretty interesting, isn't it? And I ask other individuals, you know, what they dream about, and I get various answers. But as you ask yourself that question, whether you're driving in your car, working on your project, whatever you're doing right now, I want you, as you consider the potential of your being, your soul, that you consider it is unlimited and consider that you're not building a sandcastle. Or you are building a sandcastle, but you're never going to be finished. That's the idea. Again, open lines. We are in our final half hour. The phone number here is 877-876-5227. Those of you that have been listening to the program for months and months or listening to the archives, now is your time to call in and you can have your thoughts spread all over the galaxy. Now, there's another relationship that happens between people. And this is one of the greatest effects that we have on the universe. Don't really know how to put this any other way. I'll try to do it as a scientist, but you know the way it's going to come out, don't you? The interaction between people is really the core of the society of Earth. And by the way, you hear me from time to time say that we are beings of planet Earth. It's not that I'm anti-patriotic. It's not that I'm anti-American or that I'm Scottish or whatever you might think. It is that there is a certain amount of solidarity that we need to have one with another as Earthlings. By and large, we are all of the same genetic makeup. We are all of the same genetic stock, I should say. There may be varying amounts of off-world DNA in each of us, some of us more than others. Maybe that explains the propensity that we have for this paranormal world. But by and large, we must interact with one another, even if it's not face-to-face. Our consciousness, our spirit, our soul on this earth has its weight. It has its effect. We have had guests on this program talk about karma, about adding your positiveness, your positive feeling, your positive love to a global consciousness so that it has a cumulative effect, a resonance effect on the planet or on the people on this planet. Well, that's sometimes a little hard for people to get their hands around. I'm not an expert in yoga or in chakras or the management thereof, but I can tell you scientifically that there is evidence that humans can somehow transfer energy from one person to another person. This energy can be positive or good, and this energy can be negative or evil. I know you know this, I know you felt this, but we have actually measured it in the lab as well. There have been several double-blind studies done on a process called prayer. I don't really know how to explain it any other way scientifically. Concerned people exerted their will for the care and healing of another, and it had a lab effect. I hear people talk about, well, I prayed for this and I prayed for that, or, you know, this was given to me by God because of my prayers. I don't really know how to explain that. I don't know how to treat it, but here is what I can tell you about prayer, the action of prayer itself. By my analysis, it exists in three forms. The first or lowest is the repetitious prayer, sort of like, now I lay me down to sleep, blah, blah, blah. Or I pray over my bowl of Wheaties. This is a repetitious prayer. Is it necessary? I'm not going to say. I don't really know one way or the other. I think from an obedience standpoint, praying every day is a good thing. Or praying five times a day, some religions require. That is a good thing. It creates discipline. It creates a sense that we are communicating with someone other than a mortal, another being altogether, higher than us and capable of doing things for our welfare. The second level of prayer is a little bit higher than that, and that is when we stretch out our desires to the Almighty. You can use the word God, you can use the word Great Spirit, you can use the word Allah, whatever it is that you feel is out there. Some people pray to the earth. There is something higher than us. But it's not a repetitious prayer. No, not at all. This is the prayer of yearning, a prayer for blessings like healing or like prosperity or to understand something or to overcome a habit or to learn something in school. I don't know how many times I prayed to get chemistry into my head, and it finally worked. I finally got that degree. But it is a prayer for oneself, and this is where we pour our hearts out. One of my favorite places to do these kinds of prayers is driving. Yes, I have my eyes open, but I have the windows rolled up, and sometimes I get pretty vocal about it. I realize that it's not such a strange thing anymore because I might be talking in a wireless cell phone, but in the old days, before cell phones, people would think I was pretty strange when they didn't see anyone in the car, and they saw me in there screaming at the top of my lungs to the windshield about something. Well, that's a great form of prayer, and there are great communications and great senses of peace and fulfillment and even healing that comes from this kind of prayer. The third kind of prayer is the kind that really does affect the universe. The third kind of prayer is the kind that can affect the full race of man. It can actually affect, I think, affect the planet itself. And that is when we stretch our prayers out, not for ourselves, but for another. When we exert ourselves for the healing of another, or for the consolation of another, the comforting of another, the love of another, the death of another. We pray for the heart of another person. Now, this changes everything. And this is sort of getting to the heart of what I think the human race should be all about. When we spend that kind of energy toward the welfare of another, here is what happens scientifically. we don't know how to measure the energy that's moving from the one person to the other person, but we can see the effect of that energy. Surgeons comment all the time. I have many friends that are surgeons or surgical pathologists, and they have gone in and done biopsies on masses in people or on damaged tissues in people. And then when the time comes for the surgery, either the ectomy or the repair of that tissue, they go back in, and lo and behold, nothing is there. The heart is healed, the kidney is healed, the tumor is gone, the lesion is gone, the hernia is gone, and there's no explanation for it. The body simply cannot heal itself in that manner. Some external force of energy came into that person and did that healing. And these are people that open people up with a knife on a regular basis. They know what things should look like when they get in there, especially if they do a biopsy or they do internal scoping with a camera. There's a variety of those going through either regular openings of the body or making new openings in the body, or with x-rays or MRIs. They know what they're going to see when they get in there based on those images. And yet when they lay that knee open or when they lay that the back open to go in and look at a kidney, there has a miracle that has occurred. How that happens, we do not know. But we do know that when in cases where one person prays for another, there is a transfer of energy. How this is done, you probably know as well as I do. But the key is that we pray for each other on this planet. And as we do that, all this positive energy transferring around makes a difference. It makes a quantitative difference in the harmony of the planet. I can tell you from looking at companies that I go and do consulting work at, some of them are a few dozen people and all the way up to several thousand people. But when there is a bad karma or a bad feeling in that plant cannot function. Equipment doesn't work, quality is bad, productivity is bad, profitability non-existent. The harder management drives those people with threats and penalties and firings and all kinds of disciplinary actions, the worse that plant does. But when the management of that plant turns around and starts thinking of the welfare of those people, learning their first names, walking out on the floor, showing great concern, and yes, even praying for their own people, those plants turn around. I don't care if they're making beehives or automobiles. That plant becomes popular. That energy has its effect. I know this to be true. I've been at this for over 30 years. I've measured it time and time again. How do I make that presentation to upper management? Well, I'm not going to tell you because that's how I make my living. But I can tell you that this is what we are on the verge of on this planet, this metamorphosis of the human race, the concern of one human being to another human being. This will make all the difference in the world. And that's all I'm asking you to do. It's the general philosophy of X Squared Radio. I picked X Squared because X times X is always a positive number. As you travel forward, you will begin to accelerate upward at the square of your travel forward. It's an exponential function in which you will always receive a positive result. And that's the philosophy of X Squared Radio. I hope that it's growing. I hope that it's reaching out to you. I hope that you like the quality. Next week on X Squared Radio, we are going to have Brent Miller back on. Yes, he has been on the program twice before. We have had the strangest technical difficulties. To give you just one example, the last time he was on, we made a beautiful recording. I mean, the sound levels were good, the noise levels were low, the content was flawless. As I was mixing that down to bring to you the following day for your listening pleasure and uplifting and edification, that file completely disappeared off my computer. I mean, it vanished. About 155 megabytes of file just vanished. Well, that's not a problem, because normally our network at BBS Radio, my good producer Don, always records the show. Unfortunately, at that moment, they were suffering from some fires that had occurred out in California and had damaged the cable lines, and the internet was so noisy they were unable to carry the broadcast. A sad loss to lose a three-hour live broadcast, but an even worse loss to lose the three-hour archive, because although there are several hundred thousand of you that listen to the live broadcast, there are several million people that listen to the archive, and that was a big loss. So we decided to have Brent Miller on again. Now, we have a couple of things to cover there. We're going to cover the Horizon Project, which you've heard quite a bit about on this program, and we're also going to cover remote viewing. You really do not want to miss that broadcast, and I'm going to make double backups of that broadcast so we cannot lose it. And on the 23rd, we're going to have John Gress on, and as I said earlier in the program tonight, he is the director and writer of the movie that's coming out called One Anunnaki. Obviously, the first in a trilogy, maybe the second will be Two Anunnaki, and so forth. John tells me that this movie is designed to set the stage, the time, the characters, the general theme of the series of movies. It is going to change everything. Lots of people are looking for this to come out. We did a news release on this July 5th. Normally, we see about 15 or 20,000 reads off of a news release like that. Within 8 hours, we had over 40,000 reads off that news release. So we expect great things out of that interview. The 30th of the month, we're going to be back talking about great theories. I'm trying to think who I have on. I have to pull up my website to see, but you can pull up the website and see. If you just go to www.x2-radio.com and go to the past and future programs, you can click all the way out into the middle of August, and you will see we have excellent world-class guests coming on. This final hour, though, you have just had me, and I've been sharing with you the philosophy of X Squared Radio. And, of course, you can call in anytime you like, 877-876-5227. We'll talk about anything you like. I do also want to bring you up to date a little bit on X Squared Radio's philosophy of politics. Generally, we're not going to talk about politics here, although I have my propensities. I feign the political games that are being played with the events that are occurring on the earth right now. I would like to see full disclosure of all of the information we have about UFOs. As destabilizing as the powers that be would think that is, I think it would be very empowering for the human race. As destabilizing as the Brookings Institution says that it might be to the religious psyche of the world, I think differently. I believe that people can come to terms with being a galactic community member better than they can being a created isolated being on a blue marble in the middle of vacuum. The political games that are played with that are shameful. And the fact that our planet is going through undulations along with the rest of our solar system, it is going to change the face of the world. And in the next 2 to 4 years, we will just lay it down here in digital record so that you can have it and you can listen to it again and again if you like. In the next 2 to 4 years, some cataclysms will occur on this planet. Volcanoes, earthquakes, tsunamis or tidal waves, the likes of which no living person has ever seen. Maybe, with the presence of this program and the popularity of it, as fast as we're growing, we'll be able to disseminate enough information that people can move out of the way. Are we going to be able to stop it? I don't think so. Oceans are going to warm. The frozen methane at the bottom of the oceans is going to dissolve into the water. Ice caps will continue to melt. We will be set up for some kind of superstorm activity or for some continental shelf shifting, which may cause a massive tsunami on 2 coasts at least. But this kind of sudden change in climate or sudden change in environment is going to catch a lot of sleeping people unaware. If we had one primary purpose of being here, it is to wake you up. I think if BBS Radio had one theme, besides being, if it's not mainstream, it's BBS, it would be wake up. Open your eyes. Open your ears. Listen to the message that these hosts are trying to disseminate to you. Who you are, what your potential is, why you are here, where you came from, where we can go from here. There is not a hateful word said on this network, as far as I know. And that's a pretty rare thing these days. The politics of the world are going to change things over the next 24 months. We have players. Well, I guess I shouldn't even use the word player, should I? There are forces at work on the earth right now that would greedily take possession of everything you have, everything that you have worked for your whole life. And they would do it with no sense of guilt whatsoever. Did they work for it? No. Does it belong to them in any way? No. But they will nevertheless take it from you. And whether you live or die is of no concern to them. In fact, they prefer the latter. There are evil men in the world today, which means that it is required of righteous people, or people that wish to have peace, people that wish their children to grow up without tanks rolling down the street or chemicals floating down through their air and searing their eyes out and making them cough their lungs up in the middle of the street. That means that we have to go out and defend ourselves. And thank goodness there are those in this generation that are willing to volunteer and go out and do that, as I did in my generation and they did in the generation before mine. It is not a good thing. War is a terrible thing. Why mankind continually lowers himself to violence to solve his problems or to realize his insane quest for glory, I have no idea. I don't know what they can gain out of it. I don't understand it. I can't fathom it. What it gains one person to see the death of another, I cannot fathom. But nevertheless, that does not deny the reality that it is there, and those people are after it, and they are spending everything they have and everything they are to see it come to pass. And fortunately, it is someone's duty to see that that doesn't happen. And fortunately, they have the honor to do their duty. And I appreciate it, for one, because I don't think I could go out and do it again today. Also, I think if you had the ability to do it, I think you should get out of debt. I have done that myself. just recently. I took a different path. I went to the future myself, saw where I was at, saw what I had done wrong, how I had lived my life incorrectly, and I came back to fix it. And that's what I'm doing right now. So if you have the ability of doing that, I think you need to do it. Because it will not be a good thing to be in debt in the next 24 months. You need to be liquid. I think it would be an excellent idea if you stored a little bit of food and water. I'm not telling you to panic. And I myself have been shopping for over 90 days for a supplier of emergency preparedness food, like MREs or freeze-dried food or different methods or components like that for you. And I have been unable to find a company willing to supply those to you. I hate that. I would think it would be an excellent business to be in right now, but evidently, of the more than two dozen companies that I have contacted all over Utah, Idaho, Connecticut, Michigan, Nebraska, nobody, not one single company wants to do business with you. Why that is, I have no idea. Someone wants to advertise on the internet that they have a business and they're willing to supply food storage or emergency preparedness items to you. I would think that they would be overjoyed to meet the audience of X Squared Radio, but they are not. So the search continues, and I will make this pledge to you. I feel so strongly about it that if I cannot find a company that's willing to supply you with emergency preparedness items, then X Squared Radio will form its own company, and we will go out and we will find the supplies for you, and you can do business directly with us. I do not intend on making a profit on this. This is not the purpose of this program. I told you the philosophy of X Squared Radio, and that's what we're here for. If we can find a way to provide you with these packages, which if you were to purchase a food storage package, you would be able to take care of one individual for 1 year, less the water. You might have to store water. But other than that, you would be able to survive, and not just in medium comfort. You would be able to survive with three meals a day with all of the tastes and variety that you want now, with the exception of that chicken Alfredo that they have down at Fat's Restaurant. Oh, that stuff is so good. No, you might even be able to get that as well. But that's what we're seeking after. And I promise you that if I can't find a supplier by the end of July, we will start up a company for X Squared Radio exclusively, and we will provide those packages for you. And then you'll have everything that you need. You'll have the philosophy. You'll have the awesome guests. They are appearing on other radio programs, yes. But if you have followed them to the other radio programs, I promise you, you will not find them interviewed as well as they are here. Primarily, I'm a scientist. Then I'm entertaining to you, if I can be. I didn't come from the radio business. I haven't got a golden voice or anything like that. But I will ask the questions that you would ask. And I will dig up the truth and the facts of their ideas and their philosophies and their discoveries. And you'll find them here. Whatever other great radio stations have been in the past, if they have decayed a little bit in their commercial blender, this radio station will not succumb to that. We will seek the high road, we will bring you the best guests, and we'll bring them to you in the best fashion. That is my pledge to you as the host of X Squared Radio. And we'll try to bring you as far-reaching subject matter as we possibly can. If I can get a time traveler, I will bring him on this program. If I can get a person that has traveled to other planets or been from other planets, and believe me, I have had an open call for almost a year for anyone who can bring me an off-worlder who will be interviewed on this program. I will protect every amount of anonymity I can. I promise you. No one will know where they're from or where they are. They won't be able to get to them. They're not going to dissect them. But if you want those words said globally on this planet, bring them here, bring them to me, and I will interview them, and we will have the words forever on digital media for everyone to listen to. That's my challenge. That's my promise. I bring it to you with all my heart, and this is X Squared Radio, and I am Brooks Agnew. I'm going to go ahead and play my little ending segment here, and I will be back with you again next Sunday from 6 to 9 Eastern Time. I have thoroughly enjoyed this evening, and I appreciate your presence out there. It has been our pleasure to have you here this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we try to provide the best 3 hours of talk radio on Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours where you live, send the call letters of your local radio station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, who you are. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Be aware that every life is immensely valuable. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio saying peace.